BCFM 93.2.
Disruption of family and all the kind of better things in life. This business where you have no free will, no freedom. And as I say, the destruction of the family particularly is a bad thing, an evil thing.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The latest targets in the war on terror, broadcasters, universities and internet service providers, the very people who are exposing it as a lie. And drugs as weapons against the people. Well, that's what a book by US author John Potash attempts to prove. He links the deaths of many well-known musicians to a system of CIA entrapment and then discrediting and death, part of a CIA program known as MKUltra. And it's big in Australia, but not here. ABC Television's 60 Minutes show last Sunday had an hour-long expose of the British Whitehall and Westminster VI paedophile cover-up, but it wasn't reported at all here in the UK, let alone shown on television. So what were they saying down under? Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots from over the last 2 weeks. But we start with Professor Peter Phillips, who's joining us on the line from the United States, from Sonoma County in California, I believe. Hi, Peter, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, Tony. Thanks for having me on.
First of all, we've got you on here to talk about something which is called the Bohemian Grove, which has been going on over the last week or so. Can you just tell us a little bit about why it's of interest to you?
Well, the Bohemian Club is a San Francisco-based gentlemen's club that's been around for over 125 years. And what's unique about them, I mean, they're like gentlemen's clubs all over the world, private, men only in this case, and somewhat exclusive, and tend to be upper and upper class. This club, though, in particular, has a redwood grove that they've acquired over the last 100 years. It's 2,700 acres of core old-growth redwoods, meaning, you know, 1,500-year-old trees, that they privately own, and they have a summer camp there every year. They start on the 18th of July. They run 2 weeks and 3 weekends. And it's a celebration. There'll be 2,000 to 3,000 men, 99% white. They're having theater and cocktails and feasting, conversations about literally everything, including, you know, sideline business conversations. One out of five of the people there are somebody really important. They're either a CEO of a major corporation in the world or a high-level government official or somebody running a big foundation. The rest of them are ordinary sort of rich people. Many in California, but there's several hundred from just about every state in the U.S. and many foreign countries.
So is it exclusively American, and why would we be talking about it on our politics show?
Well, it's not exclusively American, and they have invited guests every year, several hundred, that are included in the events. And so they'll have what they call a lakeside chat. So the Secretary of Defense and the former CIA director, Liam Panetta, is speaking there this week. Paul Volcker, the former Federal Reserve Chairman, retired Admiral Mike Mullen. He was former Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, founder of AOL, Steve Case, U.S. Ambassador to Iraq. These people are giving off the record, you know, lectures to thousands of people privately. So this is not public. It's not public information. And it's designed to create a sense of we're special and we're celebrating ourselves.
What about the giant owl? I mean, because there's a whole ceremony involved in it with this giant owl, and it certainly looks from a layman's point of view. Yeah, the owl. What part does that play? Because it certainly looks to me as if there's a kind of worship ceremony involving this giant owl. I mean, you know, I'm quite happy with people going all the way and doing lectures. If they want to do it in private, fine. But what on earth has an owl, worshipping an owl, got to do with what they're doing?
The first weekend, on the Saturday night of the first weekend, they have what's called the cremation of care ceremony. And all the men will assemble down to the lake, and then the orchestra's there, and there's this giant 20-foot owl. It's actually concrete, but it's been there for 80, 90 years now. And they have a ceremony. So men dressed up in monk's robes and high priest paraphernalia, looks like the Pope, have a ceremony where they march out with a band, bringing a skeleton on a canoe or gondola sort of thing, and then they say we're going to burn the cares of the world, meaning coming to the Bohemian Grove in the spirit of friendship without caring about what's going on. That sort of implies a spirit of Bohemia. But you'll have 50 men up there in monk robes with torches. And all of a sudden, all the torches are blown out, and there's only one fire left, and it's this, torch in front of the wise owl. And so, you know, Care mocks them from the woods. These loudspeakers come on. You can't destroy Care, ha, ha, ha. And then they'll light the flames again from the wise owl, and then ignite the skeleton of Care and burn it up. So it's quite an elaborate ceremony. Men take it both seriously and with certainly chuckling. But it's quite wild to see. So that's probably one of the most bizarre things that they're doing, and it's created a lot of curiosity about them.
I mean, are they, since people like the Secretary of Defense are there, some of the most powerful people in the U.S. and other parts of the world are there, one would have thought that this should be covered live on TV since it's such a big event for them.
Well, we've certainly made that recommendation to them, that they should open the grove to the public when they're not there, that the speeches should be public. On the internet and transcribed. I mean, these are important conversations. And, you can imagine Henry Kissinger sitting there with the Koch brothers and Donald Rumsfeld sipping cognac and making decisions about the world.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, is so a country club. I mean, most organisations have, many organisations have a sort of summer camp, don't they?
They do, but and I presume that Bohemian Grove is one of an overlapping series of organisations in which the elite formulate policy together. So you've got the Council on Foreign Relations.
Consensus. I mean, you know, there's consensual conversations about what needs to happen, whether it's in the Middle East or the wars or military budgets, a variety of different things. They're not formally sitting down and negotiating issues, but it's a place to build interconnections. A class-based understandings of what's important, and lasting network of friends in service to class solidarity.
Peter, have there been any leaks this year from what the discussions have been going on? Because I would certainly be interested to know if another country was up for it being invaded.
We know who's speaking. We don't know exactly what they're saying at this point, and we'll probably find out some of it. I was a guest there 25 years ago and took copious notes, but there's no recording allowed, no pictures allowed. So a lot of times we just don't really know what's fully developed there.
I mean, one does wonder, doesn't one, that if maybe this is where some of the major policies are discussed, decided on, a consensus, an artificial one, or whatever, is reached there, rather than throughout any of our democratic institutions.
Certainly major policies are discussed there. And people who are interconnected business-wise can go off and sit under a redwood tree and have conversations about their expectations for business deals. They're not supposed to do that, theoretically, but I certainly heard men talking business when I was there.
What about links between big business and politicians? Because I think for a lot of us, you know, this is one of the major worries in the modern world, particularly in the West, where you've got politicians who effectively are just simply almost owned by big business. And I wonder if there's any actual evidence that, you know, the rotating doors, that sort of thing, that, you know, that kind of thing going on.
We don't get to see the guest lists anymore. I mean, 20 years ago, we could see them every year. The several hundred people who went this year, who were guests, I would expect, certainly out of the 15 Republican presidential candidates, that a number of them have been there as guests on one weekend or the other. You can network and meet and connect with a whole lot of very important people very quickly. I mean, all within 1 mile of each other in these private camps. And so if you knew where you were going and who you wanted to see, or you had someone who was connected there, it would be a gold mine for someone that was running for office and wanted to meet very rich people.
So what about the leaks, though? Have there been any interesting leaks over the years that have later transpired in national policy?
Well, certainly we know that the Grove was used to plan part of the Manhattan Project. Stanford Research Institute was formulated there, the original ideas for it. Nixon and Reagan sat down and made decisions of who was going to run for president when. All the Republican presidents have been members, pretty much, or certainly guests there, and some Democrats too. But it's primarily mostly Republicans.
I mean, what would you like to see? You've mentioned more publicity, maybe having televising some of the speeches, that sort of thing. But they're not going to do that, Peter, are they?
Not likely. I mean, I certainly think they should. They're part of the 1% elite of the world. I mean, literally all of them are in the 1%, given that it only takes about $600,000 in assets to be in the 1%. And then there's the Koch brothers and billionaires that are there as well. So, you know, that, and the difference, of course, between a billionaire and someone with $600,000 is huge. So there's a wide range, but they still are within the top 1% of people in the world. And it's men. Women simply aren't allowed.
What does it tell us about our so-called democracy here in the West?
Top down, centralized, we don't have a democracy.
Really?
Really.
So are you saying, really saying that some of the big deals are made here and it's some sort of an oligarchy going on?
Of course. We have a class-based dominant process. We have a Congress that's paid for and bought for corporations. Unlimited campaign finance funding now. No, we no longer have a democratic process where the best qualified candidates are evaluated and reviewed by the populace and decisions are made based upon their policies. That doesn't exist.
The other thing, I mean, the interesting thing about all this is we're still presented by the media, by the mainstream press, not on this station, but by you know, the London media, the Washington media, with all these democratic representatives as the people who are in charge.
The corporate media is in the entertainment business, and the research work we do here at Sonoma State University and 20 other campuses around the country is called Project Censored, and we research the most important news stories the corporate media hasn't covered every year. We've been doing that for 39 years, so there's a huge amount of information and news that we're not able to hear. We believe deliberately on the corporate media or what's called mainstream media in the U.S. and around the world, for that matter.
I mean, we've got actually quite a lot of choice. We've got loads of channels. We've got probably something like 80 channels to choose from here in the U.K. now, like you used to have in the States.
That certainly gives you some variety and options.
Yeah, but, I mean, what you're saying is that there are stories that aren't coming out. Surely we've got a plural media.
Still dominated by, you know, those big companies here in the U.S. It's CNN, MSNBC, Fox, that are presenting pretty much a pretty solid core point of view that's very pro-capitalism and rarely has stories that are negative about the biggest corporations of the power elite in the world.
Now, Peter, I'm going to give you your dream job, I imagine, anyway. If you were asked to give a speech, a lecture down at Bohemian Grove this week or next week, what would you be talking about?
I would be talking about two main themes, wealth inequality, the fact that 30,000 to 40,000 people a day are dying from malnutrition and easily curable diseases, and that that's likely to accelerate to over 100,000 a day because of environmental impacts. I would talk very exclusively about the need for abolition movement on fossil fuels. And it needs to happen quickly. I mean, we're looking now, the latest research is we're going to see rises of the oceans by 20 feet in the next 35 years. That will inundate major portions of the world. And that's, this is imminent. This isn't just speculative now. There's hard scientific evidence that CO2 is man-produced, and it's increasing the release of methane in Siberia and the Antarctic, which will accelerate global warming even to a higher degree. So I would, you know, I would say I would call upon them for an emergency Manhattan Project style transformation of how we operate in the world today.
And let's face it, I mean, they did it with the atom bomb. They could probably do it with your proposals too.
Absolutely.
Finally, where's a good place for people to read up about the Bohemian Grove? Because it does sound like it's a pretty key policy-making place that's way out of the public radar and the mainstream media radar. So where can people follow what's going on there?
By doing an internet search on Bohemian Grove, you can find quite a bit. We have to be careful because there's a lot of mythology about the Grove that isn't true. My dissertation is online at Sonoma State University, which is probably the most last extensive research on who was there and what they were covering. So you could go to Sonoma State University and then at the library just type in the word Bohemian and you would find it.
Is there any kind of campaign about around it?
We've had protests there for over 40 years. The last big one was in 2012 where over 1,000 people from the Occupy groups and others, both right and left, were outside the gates protesting. That takes a lot of energy to put that kind of an event together, and so the last couple of years we've just seen mild protests.
Well, we'll certainly put a link up to your dissertation, your paper on Bohemian Grove on our website. That's www.thisweek.org.uk. But for now, Professor Peter Phillips from Sonoma County University, California, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Okay, thank you very much, Tony.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Interesting chat with the professor from California there, Martin. I mean, what do you you make of this, for Britain? Because the US is actually still sovereign state, different to the UK. This, and he was actually talking about gentlemen's clubs here, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think the same as we've said about Bilderberg, Tony. The problem for me is the wealthy can have private meetings where they're going to talk. I mean, Adam Smith says in The Wealth of Nations that men of business very rarely get together, even on social occasions, without some conspiracy against the public being discussed. And in a way, you can't stop wealthy people getting together. The real problem is, what are the elected politicians doing there? They should report back to us about what they've been discussing. And if they're not prepared to report back to us about what they've been discussing at these meetings, they shouldn't go to them.
The counter-extremism strategy, I said we'd be picking up on some of it in part two. And I want to go back now to David Cameron's speech he made on Monday this week about the counter-extremism strategy of the government. He's actually really making a speech laying out what they intend to do in the future. And he did touch on the role of the security service, MI5.
Ask yourself, how is it possible that when young teenagers leave their London homes to fight for ISIL, the debate all too often focuses on whether the security services are to blame? How can it be that after the tragic events at Charlie Hebdo in Paris, weeks were spent discussing the limits of free speech and satire, rather than whether terrorists should be executing people, full stop? When we allow the extremists to set the terms of the debate in this way, is it any wonder that people are attracted to this ideology?
Well, this is, I'm getting absolutely fed up with this way of approaching this topic. Now, the fact is, the evidence is overwhelming that Western intelligence services and their allies in NATO, in Turkey, and the general, the Gulf Cooperation Council states have been recruiting terrorists to fight in Syria. The British Army is going to Saudi Arabia this week, I understand, to train more terrorists to be infiltrated into Syria. And at the same time, we've got this fake pseudo discussion about how people the extremists are dominating the debate.
Hang on, Martin, because week after week on the news we've heard about British families, young Muslims, going over to Syria.
Yes, when we know that's going, but of course the evidence suggests that they're being recruited by Western intelligence agents. I mentioned the case of the British girl who was stopped by the police in Turkey trying to get into Syria, and the person who had actually recruited her was a Canadian intelligence agent, according to the Turkish police. And the Egyptian army last week arrested several ISIS militants inside Sinai. They all turned out to be Turkish intelligence officers, all reported in the Egyptian press, but not reported in our press. Now, the ISIS group, certainly the view of the Iranian general staff and the Russian general staff and the Syrian general staff, is primarily supported by the Gulf states and NATO. And at the same time, the Gulf states and NATO, including David Cameron, want to turn ISIS into public enemy number one that we've got to do something about. We had Scott Bennett on this show.
Are you saying they're not?
They are a public enemy, and the obvious way to deal with ISIS is A, cut off their funds, which would be easy to do because we know who's funding them. It's our friends the Saudis, the ones we're helping to train further terrorists. And the other thing to do is to ally with Syria and Iran. I mean, the Iranian army could come over the border into Iraq and deal with ISIS, but that would mean that we wouldn't have anything to do with it. We could just step back and let them do it. Now, if they were serious about stopping ISIS, they would stop trying to overthrow Assad. They would work with the Iranians to crush ISIS. They're not doing that, are they? ISIS is well understood in the Middle East by all sides to be a front organisation for Western intelligence services. Now, when David Cameron says, oh, that's a conspiracy theory, that's just rubbish. Everybody knows it, but at the same time, we're still trying to pretend that they are public enemy number one and we've got to stop them. Now, if we're going to stop ISIS, the first place to start doing that is to go to the top of MI6 and say, what are your links with ISIS, Captain, Colonel, General? And then we'll put those people on trial. We know you've been arming and training them. The British Army is in Saudi Arabia this week training terrorists. Perhaps they should all be put on trial. Maybe that's the way we got. If we're going to get to the bottom of this, then we're going to get to the bottom of it. And of course, the most of the videos that supposedly show ISIS beheading things are actually basically Hollywood type style pretend. The whole thing is a creation of the purpose being, of course, that we can now say, oh, we've got to go into Syria to stop ISIS. Because we can't go into Syria to overthrow Assad, because everybody eventually decided that was not a wise idea. But we're now going to go into Syria to stop ISIS. We create ISIS, we set them on the Syrians, and then we say we've got to go into Syria to stop ISIS when we've actually armed and trained them.
Also, over the last couple of weeks, it's been revealed that David Cameron knew that British pilots were flying sorties into Syria, even though the British Parliament voted against any British military action.
Indeed, and of course the point is that they haven't got any agreement from the Syrian government to do that. So if the Syrians shoot one of them down, then they're going to be they're going to get themselves into all kinds of problems, aren't they? Now, the evidence for ISIS being funded and armed by the Western intelligence services and countries like Saudi Arabia and Qatar is overwhelming. What happened at Benghazi when the US ambassador was murdered and various other people, they were shipping weaponry from Libya to Syria. Abdul Hakim Belhaj, who's been a long-term agent of the Western intelligence services, went to Syria with their help. The Turkish military have long-standing links with ISIS. The PKK, the Kurdish Revolutionary Faction, they have killed two Turkish police officers this week after the bombings by ISIS of one of their rallies, because they claim that the Turkish military were behind the bombing, because the Turkish military are in bed with ISIS. And of course, we're in bed with the Turkish military. Their chaps are trained at Sandhurst. Now,
we've heard today, for the first time, Turkish planes have carried out airstrikes against Islamic State in Syria.
Yes. So what the game is? They're going to have mission. They're going to they want to overthrow Assad because the Western powers want to get rid of Assad and the Israelis. Of course, the Israelis have admitted that they're taking militants from Syria and giving them medical attention inside Israel.
So what's the bigger picture here then?
Well, the bigger picture is the geopolitics of the standoff between the Israelis and their enemies, the desire to cut the Russians out of the European oil market and gas market, and of course the relationship between jihadi terrorism and Western intelligence services goes all the way back to the 1980s Operation Cyclone, the biggest undercover operation in history, where British SAS military personnel were training jihadis in how to shoot down aircraft in Scotland. It's all on the record. And then we go, ooh, look at this terrible jihadi terrorist network. What can we do? We're going to have need more powers.
Well, we were hearing from Fran, weren't we, a couple of weeks ago about the special boat service guy training the Tanweer and Khan, two of the London bombers over in Cumbria.
Indeed. And of course, we then get locked into the silly thing. All of these terrorist attacks, Charlie Hebdo, 7/7, 9/11, Bologna bombing, are all acts of barbarism. And I condemn them utterly. With no ifs, no buts, condemn them utterly. And those who carry them out should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. But my case is that the people who are actually the real perpetrators are embedded in the intelligence structure of the West. And they have been for decades. And it's going to be a devil of a job to get them out. But by God, we're going to do it.
One of the other things that David Cameron was talking about on Monday was problems, he sees it anyway, with universities, broadcasters and internet service providers who need to really come in line with his counter-extremism strategy. And he made this statement at the end of his talk.
Of course, Muslim communities have crucial parts to play. You're part of the solution. But we in government have got to deal with failure, like dealing with extremism in schools. We need the police to step up and not stand by as crimes take place. We need universities to stand up against extremism, broadcasters to give platforms to different voices, and internet service providers to do their bit too. Together, we can do this. Britain has never been cowed by fear or hatred or terror. Our great British resolve faced down Hitler. It defeated communism. It saw off the IRA's assaults on our way of life. Time and again, we've stood up to aggression and tyranny. We've refused to compromise on our values or to give up on our way of life. And we shall do so again. Together, we will defeat the extremists and build a stronger and more cohesive country for our children, our grandchildren, and for every generation to come. Thank you.
Twaddle. It's interesting that he mentioned the IRA there, because as I mentioned in the first hour, the Panorama programme, one of the best things the BBC have done in years, which was broadcast not long ago, was Donald McIntyre who did it. The evidence is overwhelming that the British Army was involved in running the Loyalist terror campaign who killed hundreds of innocent civilians. Hundreds. And that's just a one example. The relationship between the British intelligence services and the Islamic Fighting Group, for example, who were the spearhead of the attempt to overthrow the government of Libya, their links with British intelligence are going back decades. I mentioned earlier that the Egyptian army this week captured ISIS militants in Sinai, and then they named them all as Turkish intelligence officers who are in our allies. Where British army is going to Syria. It was in the Telegraph today. British army is going to Saudi Arabia to train terrorists. That is the reality. And at the same time, we're saying we're against extremism and violence. It's absolute hypocrisy. Absolute.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, as I said at the top of the hour, it's big in Australia, but not here. ABC Television's 60 Minutes show last Sunday had an hour-long expose of the British Whitehall and Westminster VIP paedophile cover-up. It wasn't reported at all here in the UK, let alone shown on our televisions. So I wonder what they were saying down under. Martin, this documentary is called Lords and Predators, and yet it's no mention of it really in the British press at all.
Well, isn't it interesting that in the real world that we live in, it's been broadcast in Australia, and we're going to hear a clip of it now. You heard it here first. The censorship won't work, will it?
So let's start off, and I really do have to give a warning about this documentary, as I'm sure they did on the TV over in Australia. For youngsters, it's really not suitable, and anyone of a nervous disposition. But anyway, here is an extract from a kid called Esther. Well, she's not anymore. She's a grown-up adult, but and it's bizarre, isn't it, that we have to do this kind of thing where there's an interview that's been done in Britain, and yet it's broadcast on the opposite side of the world.
Well, yes, but as I say, there are ways round the Maginot line.
Okay, so let's listen now to Esther Baker talking about what was happening to her when she was aged six.
When this video was taken of 11-year-old Esther Baker, she had already been sexually abused for years. At the age of six, a family member took you to other paedophiles, didn't they?
Yes. There would be a group of girls and a group of men, and the men would basically single out the girls, pick who they wanted, and then we'd be abused.
Raped?
Yeah. They did anything from molestation, which is touching and oral sex. To full penetrative sex.
Esther, now 32, has identified two British politicians who were among her abusers in the early 1990s. The man I'm going to show you the photograph of is a Lord, a very senior politician. Have a look at this photograph and tell me if you recognise this person.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're absolutely clear that this is the man that sexually abused you?
Yeah.
Over how many years?
Over about 5-6 years.
And him?
Yeah.
So the photograph I'm showing you now is a person who, until very recently, in fact the last election, was a fairly senior member of a political party in the House of Commons.
Yeah.
You're saying that that man abused you?
Yeah.
How can you be so sure? A lot of people might be watching this and thinking, well, she was a little girl. Maybe she's confused. Maybe she genuinely believes what she's saying, but she's confused. What do you say to that?
I'd say you don't forget those faces. No way.
Martin, yes, it's pretty disturbing, isn't it, that we don't get to see this sort of stuff over here. The other thing, of course, is that really, surely this is a job for the police to be sorting out, not for these people to be having to bare their souls on national television in Australia.
Well, I mean, there's obviously a lot more to this story than it's going to run and run. What I've always said about this is that the evidence from the Kincorra Boys' Home and other similar institutions is that the real problem is that the intelligence services have used paedophilia as a means of blackmail, and that's why you've got all these top BIP people being implicated. What probably happens, I'm just guessing, speculating, is that they have a policy of trying to compromise as many people as possible, put senior politicians, etc., so that they can be blackmailed further down the line. And the pattern that seems to be appearing in my mind is that they're actually quite rather indiscriminate about the kind of people, you know, they're not just targeting individuals. There's a general culture of paedophilia being driven by networks within the establishment in order to create the potential for blackmail. And that's why this has become so widespread. It's not just bad people doing bad things and getting away with it. There's actually a method in this madness. And the Kincorra Boys' Home in Northern Ireland, if we can come back to Northern Ireland again, where the British Army killed hundreds of people running the Loyalist Terror Campaign, as we mentioned not a minute ago, the Kincorra Boys' Home was used as a means of blackmail. So people were having sex, people taken there to have sex with underage boys, and it was being filmed so that they could be blackmailed by MI5.
Interesting that the security services, intelligence services, came up in the documentary too.
The paedophile, who called himself Peter Henderson, was in fact Sir Peter Telford Hayman.
deputy head of the British Secret Service, MI6, one of the most powerful men in Britain. Heyman was caught with diaries full of sadistic sexual fantasies about children. But the spy chief was allowed to walk free.
Well, that makes my point. I mean, I think that the culture of paedophilia in the MI5 and MI6 in particular is probably related to the era of homosexuality being illegal. So you've got lots of people in the organisation, ex-public school types, who actually are homosexual, but it's illegal. But of course, once you're a secret spy, you know, the blind eye is turned. And it's then a simple step from that to think, well, I've had sex with boys, and of course, boys start, but used to be 21, now they're 16, then they're 13, then they're 12, and so on. And of course, once you start using these techniques, De Trou affair in Belgium was also linked to NATO intelligence services, and the NATO intelligence services are orchestrators of terrorism, including Islamist terrorism, and they use paedophilia as a means of blackmail. I think the evidence is starting to pile up in both directions.
It's not just paedophilia, though, also murder was involved.
In the 36 years since your brother disappeared, has there ever been any leads, any information?
No.
Has his body ever been found?
No.
The police investigation into Martin's disappearance was at best inept. One conversation with the officer in charge has stuck with Kevin.
I just said to him that I think he's been taken by someone high up in, I don't know, establishment, whether it's a businessman or an official of some sort.
And what did that senior policeman say to you?
He said to me, you keep saying things like that, you could get hurt.
That sounds like a threat.
Well, I was like, almost fell off my chair at 17. But my mum and my dad and me, that was it. It was over with the police.
Now, police have reopened the case, also acknowledging they have credible evidence of murders committed by the Westminster paedophile ring.
Well, I mean, if intelligence services are prepared to foment terrorism and carry out paedophile acts, they're also prepared to kill people who potentially can grass them up. And of course, they're mentioning the police there, and the answer to this is for the independent police force to actually start investigating properly, as they have done in Italy, for example, exposing NATO's involvement in terrorism over decades. And the time has come for the civil police to assert its independence of the government and to investigate all this thoroughly.
Well, I said at the top of the hour, it's not being covered, that documentary over in Britain, but that's not entirely true. If you've got a copy of the Daily Mirror beginning of the week, it does refer to this very serious murder case that's now been reopened of 15-year-old Martin Allen. He vanished in London in 1979 and was last seen boarding a tube train at King's Cross Station. Also, I mean, some of this evidence has been collected, Martin, but no prosecutions. And also, as we were hearing on the documentary there, just immediate family members interviewed, nobody else apparently.
Well, the implication is that police officers have been suborned by these intelligence service groups and these elite groups. That's quite possibly the case. But if police officers have been suborned by those groups, my message to them is simple. We want you all behind bars, be you ever so mighty.
Also, there was an interview with the Totnes Conservative MP, Zach Goldsmith, on the documentary, and he had this to say.
When I first was approached by people 5-6 years ago, and my initial instinct was to dismiss this stuff as madness, as conspiracy wackos, I know that many of the things that I would have been inclined to dismiss 5-6 years ago have since turned out to be true.
What sort of things were people saying to you when they rang your electorate office and told you that they'd been abused?
These were people who themselves had allegedly experienced very serious abuse, including rape. These were children children who were associated with a care home in my constituency, which was effectively mined by this paedophile ring, people taken to a guest house nearby, also in my constituency. Key evidence not being picked up, key trails not being followed, key questions not being answered, bungled police operations and investigations stopping suspiciously. I think there has to be an element of cover-up or conspiracy, call it what you want.
Well, I think this is, you know, Zach Goldsmith is finally being forced to confront the truth about this, isn't he?
So, I mean, he's saying that there is a... when people first came to him, he was saying, well, this just... it sounded like some kind of crazy conspiracy theory. He's now coming round to the view that it's true. So how does this whole business of people being sort of not actually interested in it because they think that it's that the people are coming to them with false evidence?
Well, I think it's not helped by the prurient nature of what we're talking about. There's an awful lot of chatter about paedophilia on the internet, with people getting into various, you know, getting themselves worked up about it. And of course, in society in general, there's a sort of moral panic about it. So there's a tendency to dismiss such allegations, as because, you know, people are, you know, they love prurient stories. But the facts are starting to pile up, aren't they? And I suggest that the real thing that thread that holds all of this together is the fact that it's used for blackmail, and that various groups in the establishment have encouraged paedophilia of various kinds so that that people can be blackmailed to do things that they need them to do in relation to other.
So, I mean, are these police interviews going to be dredged up, these cases reopened? Are people going to be arrested and sent to jail?
Well, this is the question.
I mean, they're some of the most powerful people in the land, we're told, VIPs.
Well, they are, and we've heard the head of MI6 there as a suspected paedophile. The head of MI6 is quite possibly involved in Islamist terrorism. Is he going to be prosecuted? There's a question. But of course, in Northern Ireland, the provisional IRA Republican movement agreed to give up armed struggle on the understanding that there was going to be an independent police force, the Police Service of Northern Ireland, which would not be beholden to the establishment. Now, has that worked? To some extent, yes. To some extent, no. But that's the way forward. In Italy, it was the police forces that finally exposed the fact that NATO intelligence services were involved in the terrorism in that country. And in Turkey, the police seem to be taking quite an independent line, independent of their own government. These are signs of hope.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com. And leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Now, drugs as weapons against the people. Well, that's what a book by US author John Potash attempts to prove. He links the deaths of many well-known musicians to a system of CIA entrapment, and then discrediting or death, part of the CIA's program known as MK Ultra. Martin, it sounds incredible, doesn't it, that the intelligence services would want to bump off famous musicians, but there is actually some truth to this, isn't there?
Well, indeed, COINTELPRO and MK Ultra. COINTELPRO was run by the FBI, MK Ultra by the CIA. They were very worried by the social turmoil of the 1960s, the kind of questions that were being asked, people not believing the authority anymore, questioning things more than they'd previously done, and they did react. They reacted in all kinds of different ways: blackmail, assassination. Feeding people drugs, attempting to destabilize them mentally, and so on and so forth. And the evidence, again, is overwhelming that this is what was going on. And of course, what tends to happen is people say, oh, well, that went on in the 60s and the 70s, but things have improved now. No, they haven't. They've got worse. They've got worse.
So let's have a listen now to John Potash, who's come out with this book recently. It's called Drugs as Weapons Against Us, where he talks about Tupac, John Lennon, and actually spends quite a long time here, rather interesting, talking about how one of the main managers for Jimi Hendrix, the rock singer, was actually an MI6 employee.
I found all the evidence of police foul play in attempts on Tupac Shakur's life. And then I was also researching Kurt Cobain, and I read also John Lennon's book about John Lennon's death by a British attorney named Fenton Bressler, who was a London crime reporter. He spent 7 years studying John Lennon's murder and found that the CIA had actually assassinated John Lennon because of his politics and his influence. And so when I started finding all the documents on the CIA's Operation MK Ultra, that put more of a framework as to why this was going on and how this was going on. And basically that operation was using drugs as weapons against us, and us meaning really the 99%, but particularly, it was particularly brutal against leftists and leftists of color. And it was targeting activists, especially the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement, using drugs as one of its tactics to undermine those two movements. and I show how it was used against Jimi Hendrix, for example, in collaboration with British intelligence, with MI6, because most people don't know that Jimi Hendrix's first manager, a guy who inserted himself into Jimi Hendrix's life when he first made it big in Britain, was a guy named Mike Jeffrey, who said he was former MI6. And people who have studied the CIA understand usually that, you know, most people are CIA for life, and they say the same about MI6. And this guy showed all the evidence, his behaviors, his operations, everything he was doing, showed that he was continued to be part of British MI6, and he was sabotaging Jimi Hendrix's career. Jimi Hendrix's fiancée, Monica Daneman, came out with a memoir in 1996 saying that he would plant drugs on Hendrix and get him busted at the airport. And Hendrix knew it must have been Mike Jeffrey. He also, when Hendrix kept trying to play political benefits, like anti-war benefits, Jeffrey would sabotage them. One time he dosed Jimmy with a super psychedelic that messed up his guitar playing, and Hendrix had to cut his concert short, he said. And by the end of his life, Jimi Hendrix had gotten very political. He was very anti-war, and he dedicated his last album to the Black Panthers, and he talked about them in interviews. And within the last few years, his roadie came out with a book saying that Mike Jeffries actually admitted having Jimi Hendrix killed. And that happened within 48 hours of Jimi Hendrix officially firing Mike Jeffrey. So that's just one example of all this. But I argue with Operation MKUltra, the goals, there were several goals. One was to hurt the minds and competency of these activists and these musicians who were activists. Second was to get these activists to manipulate them to promote certain drugs, to get the masses to use them and undermine the competency of people that were, you know, involved in the civil rights movement, involved in the anti-war movement, or even had the potential to get involved in those movements. And another thing they were doing with that was the fact that U.S. intelligence documents said one of our goals with LSD, which was the most used drug with Operation MKUltra, was that they found that when people used LSD, it was more easy to manipulate them. And so those were some of the goals of using these drugs.
There's John Potash there. He's the author of Drugs as Weapons Against Us, Martin. It does sound incredible, but, intelligence agencies apparently take quite a lot of interest in the lives and deaths of some of the most famous musicians of the 20th century.
I don't think there's any doubt about it that they didn't like John Lennon, for example. He tried to get US citizenship, a green card, loads of times, and eventually he got it, but they were very, very reluctant to give it to him because his outspoken views on the Vietnam War. And at the time, the mentality at the top was very clear: these people will have to be dealt with and we're going to deal with them. And if people think anything's got any better in the interim, they'd be completely wrong. I think what we've got is evidence going back to the 60s and the 70s now for what went on at that time, which sheds a very interesting light on where we are now. And of course we know, for example, the Iran-Contra affair, that the US intelligence services were heavily involved in the promotion of crack cocaine in the cities, major cities of the US, as a means of criminalizing the black underclass so they could all be locked up, and as a means of creating a slush fund to pay the Nicaraguan Contras to kill health workers in Nicaragua. And that's how these people operate. They are gangsters. They still are.
Now, you're talking about the CIA's program of MKUltra there, and one of the real experts on the CIA is the Peruvian-born American filmmaker Alan Frankovich. So I found an interview with him by Alternative Views, the American news magazine that was going in the 1980s, and this is from 1982. Alan Frankovich filmed lots and lots of CIA operatives, and what he was doing, Martin, he was breaking down this kind of compartmentalized structure. So he would be interviewing various different people who really weren't supposed to know what the other ones were doing. That was quite an interesting technique, wasn't it?
It is, and of course Frankovich had a very mysterious death himself in the Houston airport.
But anyway, let's have a listen to see what Alan Frankovich said the CIA was really all about.
The reason the CIA exists is not to keep these covert operations secret from the countries that are being targeted, the Nicaraguans. These operations are secret to keep them from us, and to preclude our deciding what we want our foreign policy to be. And so it becomes moot who you vote for anymore, because the presidents are still going to go on using the secret instrument. And that's why I think the issue of covert operations in the CIA is critical.
You said there it's moot who you vote for. Again, we're having that. But this is a bit, you know, it makes you wonder how the world really works if there's no point in voting because these people are actually really running things behind the scenes.
I think there is a point in voting, which is why they assassinated people like Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy. They were potentially working within the system, going to challenge the system. I mean, Kennedy said, I intend to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces. But it wasn't the CIA that was smashed into 1,000 pieces, it was his head.
Well, one of the best types of people to ask about this are former CIA people themselves. And one of them, one of the most senior ones ever to be a whistleblower, is Victor Marchetti.
We were supporting every half-assed dictator, military junta, oligarchy that existed in the Third World, as long as they promised to somehow maintain the status quo, which would, of course, be beneficial to U.S. Geopolitical interests, military interests, big business interests, and other special interests.
Well, I mean, do people not know that the CIA overthrew scores of democratic governments and other governments that they didn't like? Surely that's common knowledge, isn't it? It ought to be common knowledge to David Cameron going on with his extremist ideology. Don't we know that this is what goes on? Of course, well, we do.
Another whistleblower is Philip Agee, and he takes a stab at finding out what happens and what's the strategy when the CIA actually get caught out. They get caught in the act.
Have government agencies like the Congress, the Senate Committee, for example, oversee the CIA, talking about the agency now being under control and that the abuses of the past have now been eliminated, as if the agency wasn't under control all along, and as if what they call abuses weren't ordered by presidents. The main argument is not with the agency, which is an instrument for policy execution, but the main argument is with the president and the people outside the CIA who determine the interests which have to be protected and how, who determine American foreign policy and then call upon the CIA and other agencies to execute that policy.
I think he's going to say there. But when what he's saying actually is quite important, isn't it? And as an insider, former insider, he's saying actually these things are ordered by the White House. It's just it's all denied.
Yes, that's true. But of course, occasionally you get some kind of rebel politicians like Kennedy, who wasn't very much an insider, but then decides that he's going to take an independent line, and then they're removed. And that's pretty much the way it works. I mean, we have freedom of speech after a fashion, and we're exercising it now. But the real world is run by these kind of gangsters with these gangster techniques. And they've spent a lot of money and time developing these techniques. So the idea that they're not going to use them is laughable. Of course they're going to use them.
And one of the things they asked Alan Frankovich when he was interviewing all these CIA people is how do they come across? What do they look like? And this is what he had to say.
It's like talking to a bunch of insurance executives. They look at themselves as technologists. In other words, this is a technique for destabilization and destroy. They never have to face the moral consequences. And you're dealing with a kind of Rotary Club version of a Gestapo. They're smiling, they're affable, they're open. I can say that I got along very well with everybody I interviewed in the film.
And one of the things he's saying there is these techniques, they're developing these techniques for destabilization, I suppose. The idea is that you can destabilize groups in your own country and also abroad.
Yeah, I mean, one's reminded of Hannah Arendt's phrase, the banality of evil. I'll bet you the real Gestapo were quite friendly, nice to their children, and good to meet in the pub.
On to another story, sort of international stuff, Martin. I mean, you can bring up whatever you want, but I look over at what's been going on in Ukraine. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about what happened in Odessa? Because this was quite a horrific killing of quite a lot of trade unionists, but actually in a trade union headquarters.
Well, they weren't trade unionists. They were protesters against the new regime in Kiev. Well, basically, Odessa is a largely Russian-speaking part of Ukraine. It's not part of one of the two self-declared republics, and the what was happening was that just as there had been protests in Kiev, mainly by Western Ukrainians from Lvov and elsewhere, in Odessa, those who weren't happy with what had happened with the overthrow of the Yanukovych regime were holding a kind of protest camp outside the trade union headquarters in Odessa. And what happened was there was a match between the local team in Odessa and a Kiev team, and the intelligence services of the state, working probably with the Western intelligence services, decided that what they were going to do was that they were brought what they call ultras, football hooligans, from Kiev to Odessa. They then started a fight, supposedly with pro Yanukovych demonstrators, who were in fact Pravi sector militants, they all wore red armbands, so that the protesters thought that they were on their side. They led the football hooligans to the protest camp. The football hooligans started attacking the protest camp, and the people in the protest camp said, let's go inside the trade union building to avoid conflict with these people. They went inside the building. When they got inside the building, people were waiting for them, and lots of people were murdered inside the building. Then the building was set on fire, and at least 40 people and possibly more were murdered. And the purpose of this, of course, is to shock and awe the Russian-speaking population.
And this part region of Ukraine is now being run by Governor Saakashvili, who's wanted in Georgia. So, well, we know what's going on there. Anyway, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7, followed by Mohammed's Arabian Nights, our sister show Dialects, here on BCFM. On Tuesdays at noon this week, you can hear from former Reuters journalist Philip Chalmers how the London media provide cover for the rich and powerful people who are undermining democracy. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, that was Marvin Rees. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. And don't let the banksters get you down.
National news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, a reservist soldier died in hospital from wounds he suffered in Afghanistan more than 3 years ago. Matt Steele has more.
Lance Corporal Michael Campbell from 3rd Battalion the Royal Welsh was shot in the stomach while on patrol in April 2012. The Ministry of Defence says despite being badly injured, he was able to draw fire onto himself so his colleagues could get better cover. He was flown...